Hi, everybody. This is Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network with Eve Harrow. This is being broadcast for the first time on Sunday, April 23rd, 2017, the 27th day of Nisan, 5777. I hope you all had a wonderful Passover holiday. And I'm very honored to have on the line Professor Mordechai Kedar from Bar-Ilan University, who I think, and a lot of other people think also, is one of Israel's experts on the Arab world and on Arab culture. So thank you so much, Professor Kedar, for joining me.
Eve, it's my pleasure and my honor.
The reason that I asked you to come on my show today is that there are many different plans, finally, that are circulating about what to do with Judea and Samaria, as opposed to the two-state solution that everyone's speaking about. And the plan that I happen to think is the most interesting is yours, which ironically, one of the names that you call it is the eight-state solution. So if you could please tell my audience, who's all over the world and are probably very, very confused about what exactly is going on here, what you think and why you are particularly suited also, I should say, maybe give a little bit of your background to coming up with this kind of very original plan to try and calm down what's happening here in the greater Israel area.
Only to put very big things into a small framework, I would present it as follows. The Middle East is divided sharply to two kinds of states. One is failure kind, and the other one is successful. The failures are Iraq and Syria and Libya and Sudan and Yemen, Algeria, and some others, while the successful are Kuwait, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and some more Emirates.
The and Israel.
For the failures
and Israel.
Is,
yes, okay.
The reason of the failure of the failing states is the fact that these states are big groupings of groups which never became one nation. Tribal groups, ethnic groups like Arabs and Kurds and Turkmens and others. Religious groups like Muslims, Christians, Sabais, Mandais, Yazidis, Druze, Alawis. And sectarian groups like Sunnah and Shia and denominations of all kinds of religions and so forth. The state, the modern state, failed in replacing itself in the place of the traditional frameworks, and people are much more loyal to the traditional frameworks, to the tribe, to the ethnic group, the religious and the sectarian groups, much more than they are loyal to the modern framework, means the state. And this is why the state is viewed as the enemy. The ruling elite of the state is viewed as dictators, not as real leaders. And everything else is the derivative of this situation. In the successful states, they are always based on one consolidated group, usually a tribe. In Kuwait, it's Al Sabah. In Qatar, it's Al Thani. Al Thani is the name of the tribe, which is the majority of the citizens of Qatar. In Abu Dhabi, for example, it's Al Nihyan. Al is a tribe in Arabic. So, this is what makes those countries successful, not the oil, because Dubai has no oil, and Dubai is one of the richest countries in the world, while Iraq and Libya and Sudan and Yemen, with so much oil, which every one of them has, is a hell of a state. So definitely not the oil is the element which makes the difference between a successful or a failure state. What makes the difference is the sociology. If there is a multiple groups like in Iraq, Syria, and Libya, this is a failing state because they can never agree on anything and they keep fighting each other in the streets and wherever. While when you have a state with one solid, consolidated group. The group functions, the state functions, and they make money, and their life is in heaven. So this is what I would say sharply, if I divide the Middle East to two kinds, this is what I find. The same thing, or the same sociology, is within those who are called Palestinians. The tribalism, which tears Iraq apart and Syria and Libya, exists here as well. How do I know? I check everything through the marriage. A girl in Hebron usually has no option to get married to a boy from Shechem, from Nablus. Why? Mm-hmm. Because they're not from the same tribe. And many other things. They don't open businesses together, don't trust each other. They compete with each other. They hate each other in many cases. They struggle against each other. So instead of implementing the failing paradigm by creating a Palestinian state which will be comprised of many tribes, what I think that we should do is to establish the emirate system here. Means an emirate in Hebron for the tribes of Hebron, which live peacefully together for hundreds of years, is the Jabri and the Kawasme and Nache, Tamimi and Abu Snena. Another emirate in Jericho for the Arikat tribe. Another emirate in Ramallah for the Barghoutis and the Tawils and the Abu Ains. Another one in Shechem, Nablus, for the Masri, Tukan, and Shaka tribes. Another one in Tulkarem for the Karmis, and so forth in Kalkilia and Jenin. In addition to the state which already exists for 10 years, which is Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And Gaza also is a tribal society, and Hamas there know very well how to correspond with this tribalism. And Gaza is a state, whether we like it or not. Gaza has the borders, and Gaza has agreements with their neighbors. Gaza has an army, and a military industry, and a police, and judicial system, and education system. And whatever a state needs, Gaza has. So Gaza is a state. And now we have to follow this paradigm and establish seven more emirates in the cities of Judea and Samaria, as I mentioned, while Israel should forever remain in the rural areas, which are populated scarcely, more or less, with some 10% of the population, of the Arab population of Judea and Samaria. Israel can offer them an Israeli citizenship. This is not a demographic threat. So this is something which can combine the culture of the Middle East, which definitely plays a major role in state stability in this region. And this is why this solution has all the prospects to succeed and to create peaceful states, these emirates, in Judea and Samaria, while Israel maintains its rulership on Eretz Israel between the Jordan River and the sea, while giving independence to the cities mm-hmm. of Judea and Samaria, and every one of them can have, you know, with agreements with Israel, access to the sea, access to Ben Gurion Airport, access to Jordan, access between themselves. Every problem can be solved with technical solutions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then to ask the obvious question, because you throw Gaza into the mix, so there's some people who would say Gaza is a terrible place, that every couple of years we have a war with Gaza. Just this week there was discussion in the Israeli government. Basically, they don't know what to do with Gaza. Every couple of years we're going to have a war. That's in between them shooting missiles. We're going to lose 60 or 70 soldiers. As the mother of a soldier, that doesn't make me very happy either. And so someone could say to you, so Gaza is so terrible, and now you want to have seven more? You want to have areas that, if they rule themselves, then they also have their own weaponry. They can let in terrorists. Why is this different than the Oslo Accords, when we gave freedoms and autonomy to these cities that you just mentioned, and they became cities of refuge for terrorists and
Oslo was wrong because what we did, that we brought terrorists from Tunisia to control the local population.
Mm-hmm. Arafat and company.
Arafat was a terrorist. Yeah. Arafat was not from here. Arafat was born in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Abu Mazen was born in Sfat. He is not viewed as one of us here in Judea and Samaria. What we should do is give the power to the local families. Now, about Gaza. Gaza was occupied by a terror organization named Hamas. And this terror organization, they know how to correspond with the tribalism of the population. And this what makes them able to control a state already for 10 years. This fact that Gaza is a functioning state has nothing to do with the relations to us. This is one thing, and this is another thing. We have to come with Gaza to a situation of deterrence. And just as we did with Egypt before the peace agreement, just like we had with the Jordan before the peace agreement.
Syria.
The existence of a state has nothing to do with peace with us or not, because this is totally different issues. Now, what happens in the Middle East is that generally, when the families were in a place where families control, they usually kick out all the jihadists from their place.
Mm-hmm.
Because the jihadists actually are threatening the hierarchy of the familial structure, of the tribal structure in the Arab world, because they want to insert a new idea of Islamism, which is against the tribalism. And whenever the tribes are the masters of the place, they deal with the terror much more efficiently than Israel does.
Well, like Jordan in 1970, Black September.
They just send them away.
Right.
Either to hell or to another place.
Well, so for example, the Hashemites in Jordan in 1970. So that's, they did exactly what you just said, and they threw Arafat out into Lebanon.
Right.
Not that it helped anybody else. It pretty much destroyed Lebanon. But I guess it wasn't his problem. So.
That's what they say. He sent them out.
Okay.
That's what they do. Either they kill them or they send them out.
So if anybody's listening and saying, but that doesn't sound like so nice. I mean, here we're worried about the people in Gaza, right? But you're saying that they know how to rule themselves in their way with their culture, be it honor, be it shame, whatever it is. And this way they can have their own regions where Israel's not involved, not in their education, not in their religion, not in anything else. And we can provide for them. Well, how would we provide access for them from city to city? How would they get from Jenin to Shechem without traveling through Israel?
By agreements with Israel, just like every other agreement. What will they have water from? From Israel, if they need. They can buy it, electricity, infrastructure, access to the city, access to the airport, access to John. Everything will be agreed upon with agreement, which will be implemented by Israel. And Israel has to negotiate with every emirate about the terms of emirate. Visa, they can issue whatever they like, and they will be independent as long as they don't mess with us.
Well, exactly. How do we keep, let's say someone from Qalqilya wants to fly out of Ben Gurion Airport because they don't have their own airport. So how do we make sure that it's not terrorists that are on road number 6 killing Israelis on their way to Ben-Gurion Airport?
Just like every other tourist who comes to Israel. How do you know if a tourist comes if it's not a terrorist?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. The same thing. He will be treated as a foreign citizen.
Mm-hmm. It's like a border checkpoint.
They do know how to deal with foreign citizens who are not desirable.
So we had an incident that just came out this week about two women who were coming into Israel from Gaza to be treated for cancer. And it turns out that they were terrorists. I mean, they were trying to smuggle in all kinds of explosives. So, and they were fortunately caught. So we would have to implement that kind of same security coming from everywhere. Let me ask you, Dr. Kedar, what is your background here for my listeners who are not familiar with you? How did you How are you so knowledgeable about Arab culture, where you're saying that the answer to the issue that we have here is to work with their culture and not impose a foreign idea on them, which is what happens after World War I, 100 years ago, that idea of the nation state, which is smack down here in the Middle East, and it is the cause probably of many of the wars that we have going on here right now, this unnatural body of control. So what is your background? How did you get to where you are today?
Well, I was born in Tel Aviv 64, a little bit more, years ago, to a Yiddish-speaking family. But I fell in love with Arabic thanks to the teacher, Dov Iron, a great man who really was a real leader before he was a teacher. And a group of 13 kids in Zeitlin High School, Ironi Bet, fell in love with him and with Arabic, and we were so good in Arabic that we went to the army, to the in military intelligence right after the high school. And then we had our Arabic even better, and then I went to the university, to Bar Ilan, in the beginning of the 90s, my PhD, and I'm there for 24 years already. And Arabic actually is the key, the language, because you cannot understand anything about the culture without without the language, which enables you to read whatever is written in this language, like newspapers, books, poetry, literature, jokes, all these things which actually reveal the culture of those people. And this is how I became so familiar with the Arab world. And I look, as much as I know, I don't know everything. The Arab world is so complicated and really needs a lifetime research, as I already more than 50 years am involved in the Arab world. So including the Arab media, I speak much in the Arab media since I speak Arabic. And this is, I would say, how I became so familiar with these issues. And this is why I'm so sure that only the Emirate solution can bring any remedy, not only to the Israeli-Palestinian problem, but to the whole Arab world. If instead of creating states which are based on nothing, look, there is no nations in the Middle East. There is no Iraqi nation. There is no Syrian nation. There is no Libyan nation. So how can you have a nation state without a nation? There are tribes and ethnic groups and religious and sectarian groups which never made it nation. Nation can be done by individuals. A society which is individual society, like in America, like in Britain, like in here in Israel after the Aliyah of the Jews, or in Europe, which went through fragmentation of the families due to the industrial revolution, which was in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And people immigrated from the villages to the cities as individuals. So this is how nationalism actually grew up in Europe and enabled the Europeans to adopt the idea or to create the idea of a nation state. Here, the Arabs didn't go through industrial revolution. They still live, or most of them still live in family frameworks, in tribal frameworks, in the villages, whatever. And even in the cities, there are cities of individuals like Cairo and Alexandria, but many of the cities are also tribal cities. So since tribalism is the name of the game, I think that this is the only way how to bring some remedy to the problems of the Middle East, by creating emirates everywhere. Based on local families or clans or tribes, the name is not so important.
What would you do about the refugees, the Arabs who came from Haifa and Akko in 1948 during the course of Israel's War of Independence, what they call the Nakba, where they don't accept the partition plan, they wage war on our fledgling state, they lose. And as a result, they don't go back to their homes and they are put by other Arabs in refugee camps in Judea and Samaria, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, in Gaza. And so they would have, I suppose, lost that tribal affiliation because they are not where they originally were. How do you see squaring that issue?
Well, I tell them whenever I have to encounter this refugee issue in the Arab media, I tell them very frankly, I said, look, guys, we Jews were loyal to our country for 2,000 years. And after 2,000 years, God enabled us to come back to our country. If you Palestinians remain loyal to your country, what you claim is yours, for 2,000 years, maybe then Allah will let you come back. until then, we'll say, but it depends on you if you remain loyal to your country. So this is what I tell them. If you deserve to come back to your country, Allah will bring you back as he brought us back to our country. They don't like this answer, of course, but this actually delegates the problem to Allah. Not only this, I also tell them that many of the Palestinian refugees are not originally Palestinians because they carry names like Al-Masri, which is the Egyptian,
the Mitzri,
or
right.
Al-Hurani, which testifies as he's from Syria, Tarabulsi is from Tripoli in Lebanon, and all kinds of places which are embedded in their names, which testify that they are not originally from Palestine. They came to work here in the Jewish towns and villages and whatever was there since the late 1880s. But this is, I would say, another answer which I give them in the Arab media is that without the independence war of 1948, there was no refugees. And who made that war? Is the Arabs who invaded the newborn Israel and created that and started that war. So since the Arabs are responsible for that war, they are responsible also for the outcome of that war, which is the refugees. But unfortunately, in the Arab world, they don't know how to spell the word responsibility because they seem not to be responsible for what they do to themselves. So this is the problem. The problem is an Arab problem before it is an Israeli problem. So, you know, when you combine all these answers, you can understand that there is what to say, there is what to do. And I say also when the Czech Republic will allow the Sudeten, the Germans who were expelled from Czechoslovakia right after the Second World War, when they let them back, we will let you back.
Mm-hmm. But somehow the world holds Israel to a different standard than everybody else. So the fact that there are refugees, there were Jewish refugees who were close to a million Jews who were thrown out of the Arab world in the early 1950s as a result of the creation of Israel. We didn't put them in refugee camps. That's half of Israeli citizens, more or less, right now are Jews who came from Syria, Aleppo, from Libya, and all these countries because they lost their homes and not because they started a war, simply because they were Jews. But those kinds of double standards, for some reason, and maybe you have an idea what that reason could be, they don't apply to Israel. That same rationale that's used for the rest of the world doesn't apply here.
The Arabs made their refugeehood into a profession.
Mm-hmm.
We did not profess our refugeehood. We changed our mindset from refugees to olim. We didn't even call them refugees. We called them Olim Chadashim,
new immigrants,
which came back to their country.
Mm-hmm.
This and this is what enabled us come over this thing of the refugeehood. Because my parents were refugees.
So were mine.
But they didn't have the mindset of refugees.
Right.
They had the mindset of people who came back to their own homeland. Mm-hmm. And this is what enabled them being liberated from this mentality of refugees and beggars. Now, by the way, it is hard for us to remind the world that many Jews, especially from Arab countries, are actually refugees, because people in the world ask us, hey, where were these refugees? Where were they been for dozens of years? Why didn't we hear about them ever? Only now you started talking about them. Okay, so this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Which we have here by reminding the world about the Jewish refugees who talked about them in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s all the way to the late 90s. Who talked about this?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the problem. The Arabs keep hammering on this on this issue of refugee because they made it into a profession.
Mm-hmm.
Look, UNRWA,
right.
the agency which is designed only to take care of the Palestinian refugees, while all the other refugees in the world are dealt with totally different criteria, with totally different resources. And UNRWA also was, I would say, established by the world, especially by Arab pressure, in order to perpetuate the problem rather than solving the problem. And this is why we still people are still talking about the Palestinian refugees, although they are the last group of refugees from the 40s, from the 1940s, which still people are talking about. You know, the world was covered with refugees after the Second World War. Who remembers them? Who knows them? Who
mm-hmm.
knows about this? Who allocates money until this big money, until this very day, in order to take care of refugees of the 40s?
Of great grandchildren of refugees.
Of absurd.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, as part of your plan, of your 8-state solution, of your Emirates solution, you would say that UNRWA needs to be dismantled and the people in the refugee camps need to be resettled in where? And finally, put an end to that.
You say refugee camps. Look at these camps. They are really neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Neighborhoods. And they are there for 3 generations already. There's no refugee camp. There are no tents and no huts like in Syria or in Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
These are real neighborhoods. There's not refugee camps anymore. It is called refugee camps only in order to blackmail the world, especially monetarily.
Mm-hmm.
But In on the ground, these are nice neighborhoods. Neighborhoods could be nicer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it can be rebuilt. And you know what? Let me tell you something. There are even all kinds of deviations. In Dehesha, I heard it in Dehesha, near Bethlehem, the inhabitants, those who live in the refugee camps, are not the refugees. Because the refugees, what they do, they rent the houses to people who come from outside, because in the refugee camp you don't pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Arnona, you don't pay
right.
the local taxes because you're refugees. So living in a refugee camp actually is much cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So people from the outside rent houses in refugee camps in order not to pay the taxes.
Amazing.
So the refugees rent out those houses and they move to other places.
And they're laughing all the way to the bank. I heard this. I heard something similar.
The American taxpayer yep. money.
Yep.
And they laugh about everybody.
I heard something very similar.
What, to make money out?
Right. Well, I was in Jericho a couple of years ago, and I heard the same thing from somebody who's a refugee in Jericho. He's sitting in a 10,000 square foot house for free. Because he's a refugee. So he's given the house. He doesn't have to pay any taxes. He gets all kinds of stipends from the world because he's a refugee. And he said to me, this is so great. He said, we're fooling the world here. We're doing whatever we want. We're getting tremendous amounts of money because we're the so-called victims. And we're having a great life. He said, I have no complaints whatsoever. Of course, he's going to say that to me, not when there's a camera running and not when anybody could hear him say that, because otherwise his own people would kill him for outing the secret. But and I know that you've had many, 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 many conversations with Arabs over the years
yeah.
where they tell the truth because they know that you understand where they're coming from.
They make jokes out of everybody.
Yeah.
Look, not only this, they get free sacks of wheat and sugar and
right.
rice and some other things. And this is for free. And it says on the sack that it is free not to be sold. So what do you think they do with this? They sell it.
Mm-hmm.
They get it and they sell it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another way how to make money.
So to get back to the program with the Emirates, because there's so many questions here, would they have a citizenship in a country? Like if they,
yes.
where would their
Everyone
passport
will
come
have
from?
Its own citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And look, if they want to make a federation, let them make the federation as long as as our peaceful federation, it's okay with me. I have nothing against it. But every city will be a unit, different, separate, and from my point of view, it can be independent. And yes, and we will make sure that all the pipes which they import will be made of plastic and not made of iron, at least for a while.
And if they say they're building something and they want to export to Europe, I don't know, they're growing flowers.
No, they don't build missiles.
But as long as it's for civilian and peaceful purposes. What about, let's say, a seaport in Gaza? What would your feeling be about that? Because one of the things that we're hearing since you've thrown Gaza into the mix is that there's a blockade on Gaza and Gaza's the world's biggest prison. I mean, how does your plan change that? If Hamas is still ruling Gaza, and forget about them not being very nice to Israel, to put it mildly, they're not apparently so wonderful to their own people. So, you know, if someone's listening to this and coming from a very humanistic perspective, which Westerners tend to come from with a complete misunderstanding of what happens here in the Middle East, that it's power and respect that it would keep the peace. And that's a very, very different mindset from the West, which is democracy and freedoms that are not exactly inculcated yet here into the Middle East. So what would you say about Gaza? Leave Hamas in power and let them do whatever it is that they want to do to their own people?
A seaport in Gaza, at least in the foreseeable future, I don't see it yet because of various reasons.
Like trust.
However, they can very easily use Ashdod seaport. It's only 20 kilometers to the north. There is a train almost all the way down to Gaza, to Sderot, and a few more kilometers, it comes all the way to Gaza. And there is no economic reason to build another full-scale harbor in Gaza when you have the same thing 20 kilometers to the north. This is illogical from the economic point of view. They can use Ashdod if they are peaceful, and for peaceful purposes, this will also, you don't need any problems of security. You can check whatever comes, just like you check today. And this can be a solution which can be implemented tomorrow if they only really want to import things from other places. The problem with Gaza is that they don't want to yet. They don't want to arrange normal life.
They don't want a good life for the people.
They spend much of the money on tunnels and on missiles and everything. So why bother having an harbor? They can use Ashdod Harbor freely.
But in the meantime, it's hard for me to see the leadership of Gaza accepting your plan because they don't want there to be peace with Israel. If they did, when we left Gaza in 2005 and destroyed, 21 Jewish communities there and pulled 10,000 Jews out of their homes, and there were factories and there were all kinds of industrial zones that were built on the border of Gaza and Israel in order that their people should have normal lives and, and get a good economy. And then the Hamas attacked everything, attacked, of course, the leadership and took over and attacked the factories also because they don't want their people to have a good life. How do we deal with this? How do we deal with trying to, on a humanitarian level, give people a decent life, give even people that we would consider our enemies, but give them dignity, give them a decent life, give them breakfast for their children and lunch for their children and good jobs and good education and good health care without giving them the ability to destroy us? I understand how this could work in the seven cities of Judea and Samaria, where we could kind of, do that on what the Palestinian Authority was supposed to do, but failed for the reasons that you gave. But with Gaza, you're dealing, their leadership is their worst problem. How do we get around that? Do we impose this? How do we do this?
Well, I think that the party which imposes this is the people in Gaza. As you might know, there is a big shortage of electricity in Gaza because the only power station which they have there is not capable enough to produce electricity for all the strip, all the day. And they need gas, means fuel, from abroad. And this is why they depend on Israel for both the fuel and more electricity, which Israel gives them through through some lines which go down from Ashkelon power station into Gaza. Now, recently, because of the problems with the PA and taxation on fuel, the Hamas authorities had to reduce the number of hours every day which they produce electricity. And today, they can provide some 6 hours a day, 6 hours, like a quarter of the day, electricity to the houses or households. This created a big wave of resentment, demonstrations, and instability. And now Hamas actually feel, or they know, that they have to provide. It is not enough the jihad. It's not enough the fight with Israel. It's not enough the tunnels. It's not enough the missiles. They need also to provide. And now they know it, because the people demand it, and the people need electricity. And electricity today is not a luxury.
No.
Electricity is a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And so is food, and so on and so forth. Israel brings into Gaza every single day, except for Shabbat, 900, almost 1,000 trucks. Some of them are double trucks, loaded with food, with
medicine,
medical equipment, with construction equipment, which they actually use for tunnels.
Which the Hamas steals to use to wage war.
So Israel actually feeds them and drenches them and gives them electricity and everything. And this is daily life in Gaza. And since 2014, almost 3 years, we have more or less stability. And this is what I mean by pressure from below, which creates some kind of stability. I'm not talking about hugs and kisses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about normal life. Just look at the number of Israelis who want to move to Sderot, to Ofakim, to Netivot,
to
those places which are surrounding Gaza. And there are hundreds of Israelis who are standing in line. There's not enough apartments in these towns. And this is what happens. Daily life, at the end of the day, force itself on the governments. Even Hamas are not exempt from providing the daily life of people once they become a government, and this is what they face today.
Although, these
processes take time.
Aren't you and
it cannot happen from one day to another.
Aren't you and I,
and
though,
Hamas,
subsidizing this?
Organization starts to behave like a state already years. However, since they act like a state, means they want stability rather than a war with Israel, there are other groups like the Salafis and the Jihad and some others who challenge them today, just like what Hamas did 25 years ago to the PLO or to the PA. Exactly the same thing. And those Salafis actually are calling Hamas Mishmar HaGvul, means Mishmar HaGvul, means the
border police,
border guard for Israel. And this is a very, very, I would say, sarcastic way how to call Hamas, that they actually are guarding the border with Israel, which they actually do, in order not to create problems with Israel. So this is what happens in Gaza. Gaza became a state, whether we like it or not.
But
spiritual point of view, but peaceful, not peaceful, but, you know, you can live near Gaza, just as we lived with Egypt until the peace agreement, until how we lived with Jordan until the peace agreement. So this is what goes in Gaza. It's not ideal, yet it is tolerable.
But my understanding is that they don't pay the electric bill to Israel, that the Israeli taxpayer is essentially subsidizing their electricity, which is, I mean, as an Israeli taxpayer, both of us, I find distressing. Would you say that we should treat them just like another country? You don't pay your bill, you don't get electricity.
No,
How can we do that? They do?
In a way or another, they pay. At the end of the day, they pay. whether fully or not fully, they pay the debts. This is not the problem. The money is not the problem. There is another thing, that it's some kind of symbiosis. Look, Gaza today is like 1.7 million people. Israel produces food, you know, agriculture and other things. We export to Gaza some sixth of our food production, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Like 16% of the food production of Israel goes to Gaza. Israel depends on it. Means at least thousands of families are making a living
mm-hmm.
on the food.
From selling food
to Gaza.
Gaza. Yeah.
And we have to admit that if we close the border with Gaza,
mm-hmm.
so they don't get food, and some kind of, let's say, pressure on them, it really maintains a pressure on thousands of Israeli families who actually are living on this export of food to Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
So, in order to speak frankly, we also benefit
mm-hmm.
from the fact that Gaza buys food from us. It's not a one-sided
mm-hmm.
action. We also know how to cut some.
But that's what it should be between neighboring states, that each has something that the other one needs. And, you know, like you said, it's some kind of symbiotic relationship. All right. So just to end off, because we could talk about this for many, many hours. This is a fascinating topic and this idea that you have. But I just wanted to expose my audience to an out of the box way of thinking, to something beyond this ridiculous
yeah.
two state
solution.
If you
have any access to the White House or any of the audience have an access, I will be very happy to come and to
mm-hmm.
explain this approach to the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
to the crew of Trump, which they could use such an insight about the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever wants some more details about this solution can find it online. There is a website, www.palestinianemirates.com.
Okay.
Palestinianemirates.com. A friend of mine from Florida established this website. He maintains it. And this is in English.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very informative.
Mm-hmm.
Has some kind of maps. And definitely. However, what I do need still to produce is a book, a technical book, which will show every emirate, like Hebron, Qalqilia, Ramallah, Jericho, how everything is solved. Roads, water, sewage, electricity, industry,
the
access,
kishkes, the actual
issues.
Details. Yeah.
I need a crew of engineers and people who deal with these things in order to establish this solution
mm-hmm.
on a book which can be handed to politicians, to whoever needs it,
mm-hmm.
in order to present this idea in a professional way. Whoever wants to take part in this effort should get in touch with me.
Mm-hmm.
I will be more than happy to explain it and to
okay.
make him as a partner.
So you can be in touch with me, everyone.
Idea, which in my mind is the only solution.
So Eve at thelandofisrael.com, and I will pass it on to the professor. Let me just ask you, this popped into my mind. Have you spoken to the leaders of these tribes in these different...
Yes, definitely.
And what do they say about it?
In three places, I sat with the families, and they all say immediately, okay, how do you kick out the gangs of the PA which you brought
the
in?
The thugs, yeah, they blame us.
In the beginning of
rightly
the night.
So.
First of all, get them out.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, most of the questions were about technical issues,
mm-hmm.
not about principal issues. They have, in principle, they have nothing for the PA or Palestinian state.
Yeah.
On the contrary, they know that this state will be corrupt, will be dictatorial. Look, Abu Mazen, that whole world is hugging and kissing him. He's actually a dictator.
Yeah.
He is there already 11 years out of four
right.
of his term.
Right. Crazy. All right, people
okay?
listening.
What is this if not a dictatorship?
Right, right. Well, we're gonna end this interview, but I would be really delighted and honored to have Dr. Kedar back after a lot of you listening to this show have gotten in touch with him through me, eve@thelandofisrael.com. And to move this forward, let's start thinking out of the box. Let's start thinking with the way people here in the Middle East think and not imposing solutions from the outside into an area that is not going to accept them, because this is just not the way we roll here. So thank you so much, Dr. Mordechai Kedar, for illuminating us on a different way of trying to bring peace to the Middle East and to Israel and without hurting our security.
Thank you very much, Eve, for giving me the pulpit. Bye, Shabbat Shalom.
And thank you to all who are listening, and to Tabitha and to Ben. Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation. I will be back next week. Thank you so much, everybody. Goodbye for now.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is Windows of Jerusalem Apartments. Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments offers luxury 5-star short and long-term rental apartments in the heart of Jerusalem's city center. Elegant and modern, inviting and comfortable. The view, the location, the great apartments, and the staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com. That's windowsofjerusalem.com.
Do you like picking strawberries or blueberries in the spring and summer? What about grapes? If you were to take an experience like picking grapes and move it to the heartland of Israel, this is when an experience becomes prophetic. Young and old, singles and families are all invited on this adventure of a lifetime. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to join us on the mountains of Israel, where prophecy meets reality. Go to hayuvel.com, that's HAYOVEL.com, for more information.